In the words of the Admiral James Stockdale, who am I and why am I here? Hello, everybody. I'm David Schuster, and sorry for that reference to a 1992 presidential campaign. Good to have you here. John, after one day back, he's off. He's actually attending a conference. So we're going to do our best to try to chase away the entire Dragon Squad. I'll probably chase them away. But you should all stick around anyway, because we've got Adrienne Lawrence here, and she always has something very smart and compelling. Adrienne, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing okay. It's an interesting election day on this Tuesday. We're going to get into that and much more, including all of the latest stuff that's happening across the country, around the world. But first, let's start with the immortal Donald Trump. And here we go.
Trump, how's it going in there?
All right, so Donald Trump, they're making that motion, zipping his lips, not speaking, which is interesting in and of itself.
Wait. Donald Trump didn't speak. He didn't say a word. He zipped his lips. What happened? Oh, that's right. He's under a judge's gag order. So he's simply leaving it to his attorneys to do the yelling and screaming outside of court. But in any case, while Donald Trump did not say much, obviously, as he left the courtroom, it was a very crucial day for him because he actually did take the witness stand, and the testimony was fascinating and meaningful. So let's get into it. In his testimony, the former president and current frontrunner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination stood by the valuations of his properties that other co-defendants have sought to distance themselves from. CBS News reports, the numbers of my net worth are substantially more than the numbers you have in the financial statement, he said in one exchange. Therefore, you have no case. The prosecuting lawyer, Kevin Wallace, posed questions about the valuations of Trump's and his company's properties, including Mar-a-Lago, Trump Tower in Manhattan, and an upstate New York estate known as Seven Springs. Trump defended the financial statements, listing the supposed value, saying that even those valuations have been determined to be inflated were too low. He added that he would not be willing to sell several properties because they were worth so much. Judge Engoron's pretrial ruling found that Donald Trump is liable for fraud and noted that the local assessed value of Mar-a-Lago, for example, was $18 million, but that the Trump organization valued it at hundreds of millions of dollars more. Well, the former president said in his testimony that he believes it's worth as much as $1.5 billion, $1.5 billion for Mar-a-Lago. Well, Trump then described a hypothetical scheme in which a person calls their own home a club to save money on taxes. There are a lot of advantages to having it as a club. The smartest thing to do would be to have a club and have one member. Trump was also asked about the Scottish golf club's valuation. He argued that whether it was accurate to value one of the Scottish golf clubs as if he had built 2,500 new homes on it, when in fact, he has built none and is limited by contract to just under 1,500. But Trump said, at some point in my old age, I'll go there and build the most beautiful thing we've ever seen. Well, related to the financial statements, which is, of course, this is a huge admission. Donald Trump acknowledged his role in inflating numbers to obtain loans. And that's what this case is all about. It's not a criminal case per se. The question is whether Donald Trump should be banned from doing business in New York and whether or not he should pay fines of perhaps more than $250 million. The theory has been that he and his organization overinflated asset values in order to obtain favorable bank loans and defraud insurance companies. Well, Mr. Trump was accused of inflating his net worth to defraud banks and insurers, acknowledged helping to assemble annual financial statements submitted to the banks. I would look at them, I would see them, and I would maybe on occasion have some suggestions, Mr. Trump said. Donald Trump was also caught in a lie about paying off a loan. Late in the day, Donald Trump described a loan to a Chicago property as having been long since gone. When he was pressed on that detail, he conceded it was actually paid off very recently. The prosecutor, Wallace, then asked, are you aware that the Trump Chicago loan was paid off last week? Trump said he was, and that my son recommended it, referring to Eric Trump, who testified about that and other properties earlier in the trial. Adrienne Lawrence, what do you make of all of this?
Well, I make of it that Donald Trump does not like to take responsibility for anything. I absolutely love the fact that the moment he's asked a question, he will throw his sons under the bus. Oh, it's my son recommended. Oh, my son advocated for it. This man, he clearly is one who does not want in any way to be accountable for his actions. The fact is that him being a leader of this enterprise, he is responsible, even if he hires the best accountants, as he says. He is the one that offered these prices. And the thing that I love about this case is that, you know, there's already been a conclusion that he is liable. The question is just how much. And I would love for him to be hit with that full $250 million in fines and shut down in New York, because the people of New York deserve a whole lot better than to have the Trump family continue to do business and to continue to defraud them and the people there.
Trump's ego, obviously, I suppose, is what caused him to want to testify that he can have his word. And Donald Trump is used to saying, oh, things went great. I want to play for you Donald Trump's reaction. And then I've got a question for you on the other side. Here's Donald Trump's reaction to when Donald Trump was asked as he left how it went. Watch.
I think it went very well. I think you were there and you listened and you see what scam this is. This is a case that should have never been brought. It's a case that should be dismissed immediately. The fraud was on behalf of the court. The court was the fraudster in this case. They made references to assets that were very valuable, and they said they had no idea. They had no idea what the numbers were when they said $18 million for Mar-a-Lago, and it's 50 to 100 times that amount by any estimation.
Pretty circumspect for Donald Trump. And even in his post-testimony Truth Social post, he was far from what we're used to. Donald Trump wrote, I spent the whole day in Manhattan court, compliments of my political opponent, Crooked Joe Biden. Legal scholars agree, but this is a case that should have never been brought. And it wouldn't have if I wasn't running and winning for president. It's sort of interesting that he's being sort of more sort of circumspect in his comments on camera, because, of course, while he was on the witness stand, at one point the judge yelled at him and yelled at his lawyer to sit down when she interrupted. And so it was very combative and adversarial. I guess the big question, Adrian, that a lot of people have is, how much damage did Donald Trump do, or how much value did he add to his defense? And there's some, it seems like the legal community feels like, well, he didn't help himself by testifying. But what was your view on all this?
I definitely don't think that he helped himself at all. By virtue of the fact that he really doesn't provide anything concrete whatsoever, he simply seems to think that just because he would like something to be valued at X amount, that it thus should be valued at X amount. It's like this man creates these notions and ideas of what facts should be when that is only fiction, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sure as far as the jury is concerned. The thing that really gets me is what's going to happen in the aftermath, because as we noted, he is already liable. It's a question of now how much, but it also should make other attorney generals in other jurisdictions looking a little bit closer as to his tax filings. Like, he has a hotel in DC and he has properties located in various places. If he was doing this throughout New York, you can't tell me he wasn't also doing this in other jurisdictions. So where are the prosecutions coming there?
One of the theories that the Donald Trump defense team has floated is that the only reason, of course, this is being brought is because Donald Trump's running for president, and because Democrats need this platform to somehow enable the Attorney General of New York to speak out against Donald Trump and criticize him. That was their argument, that this is all about enabling the Attorney General to somehow lambast Donald Trump on the steps of the courthouse in order to hurt Donald Trump politically. Well, New York Attorney General Letitia James responded to all of that and also responded to the day of testimony. Here's what she said on the courthouse steps.
He rambled, he hurled insults, but we expected that. At the end of the day, the documentary evidence demonstrated that, in fact, he falsely inflated his assets to basically enrich himself and his family. He continued to persistently engage in fraud. The numbers don't lie. And Mr. Trump obviously can engage in all of these distractions, and that is exactly what he did, what he committed on the stand today, engaging in distractions and engaging in name calling. But I will not be bullied. I will not be harassed. This case will go on. We look forward to hearing the testimony of Ivanka Trump on Wednesday.
And while Letitia James, of course, is speaking out there in the courthouse, Donald Trump does have his supporters, even if he's fairly muted. There was, of course, his attorney, Alina Habba, who condemned the judge and criticized the judge for telling her to sit down, which she said was rude. I'm not sure she necessarily understands how courtrooms operate. But in addition to the legal team, there are, of course, Donald Trump's political supporters. And Texas Senator Ted Cruz has been hitting the media circuit to attack New York Attorney General James and the judge Engoron. Here's Ted Cruz.
What Eric Trump was just saying about the unfairness of this proceeding is exactly right. Letitia James is a hardcore partisan. She campaigned saying, I'm going to get Donald Trump. I'm going to go after Donald Trump. This judge, by all appearances, is a hardcore partisan who hates Donald Trump. And we can anticipate he's going to rule against Trump. He doesn't like Trump. He wants to punish Trump. Look, you and I have both been to Mar-a-Lago many times. It is an extraordinary, it's a spectacular property. The idea that that's $18 million is utterly laughable.
compared to what other properties in Palm Beach are worth. $18 million is an accurate assessment. Donald Trump insists it's hundreds of millions of dollars, even suggested $1.5 billion. It doesn't really matter what he thinks. Adrian, as I get it, it's what does he tell the banks and the insurance companies? And if he's overinflating the value of Mar-a-Lago, even if Donald Trump thinks it's $1.5 billion, he can say that publicly, I guess. He can claim that. But once he actually puts it in bank documents and insurance documents, that's where it becomes fraud if there's this contradiction with the assessor, right?
Absolutely. The fact is that we have assessors because we have individuals who are supposed to be working under the same principles and values and standards so that they can come up with a very consistent judgment on how much certain things are worth. And the fact that Donald Trump decides to throw that to the wayside, so again, he can create his own facts, again, that fiction is fraud. And it's something that he needs to be held accountable for. I really, really hope that this jury comes down on him and hard, because we cannot continue to have someone who is such a grifter in a position of leadership or in a position that they can even run companies in New York there. It's really pathetic and sick as far as I'm concerned.
There are these other cases, four criminal cases that are out there, including, of course, the Georgia election fraud case. There's the Washington, D.C. federal case. There's the New York criminal case for Donald Trump's hush money payments. It feels like, and of course, there's the documents case in Florida, again, a special counsel federal investigation. It feels like, you know, Donald Trump, obviously, he's in more jeopardy from those criminal cases than a civil lawsuit, because the worst that could happen to him in a civil lawsuit is pay hundreds of millions of dollars of fines, have his businesses told you can no longer operate in New York City. But is there some perhaps momentum that starts to get created if, in fact, Donald Trump is found liable for paying all these fines, his businesses get taken away? Does that perhaps start to soften things a little bit in terms of how a jury might go against Donald Trump in one of these criminal cases?
I would definitely say so. The fact is that he built his entire image on this thought that he is such a great businessman. And as we now definitely know, people in New York City have said this man has been a fraud since day one. And so having that emperor finally be seen with no clothes on is something that I believe will have somewhat of a ripple effect when people recognize, hey, this person has inflated every valuation. He is not the big businessman. He is nothing but a fraud. And so having that accountability, hopefully, people would be willing to actually recognize and see who he is for who he is. But the problem is now that we have so much mis and disinformation out there and we have his cult following that I don't necessarily know how much of a dent it will make, but I damn sure think it's going to change the way he approaches his time here in the United States.
Another issue. One in Washington, D.C., involving sort of the election interference and January 6th. And that is both judges, the judge in New York and the judge in D.C., the federal judge in the criminal case, have issued gag orders, which essentially means that Donald Trump cannot go on Truth Social and his other platforms as he has in the past and criticize. He criticized the judge's clerk in New York, saying that she was Chuck Schumer's girlfriend. And he retweeted or resent a photo of her with Chuck Schumer. And because of that, the judge issued a gag order saying you cannot criticize court staff, personnel, et cetera. Then there was the gag order that was imposed on him in the federal case in Washington, the criminal case, because Donald Trump has been attacking personally some of the potential witnesses in that case, including Bill Barr. And because of that federal gag order by Judge Chutkan, first she released it for 9 days. She let Donald Trump make some arguments. Then she reimposed it. One of Donald Trump's former lawyers, Ty Cobb, has suggested that he thinks there's a good chance that Donald Trump could actually end up getting jailed for violating the gag order in D.C. And as a result, maybe that explains why he's being so quiet. Would it be very difficult? I mean, there's all these questions about, could you ever jail a former president? But if a president like Donald Trump actually violates a gag order in a federal criminal case, is it that complicated for a judge who's already given repeated warnings to say, okay, you've done this again, now you're going to spend the night in jail?
For precedent value, no, not at all. This is exactly how a judge would handle it there in the federal courts in D.C. In the event that someone continued to skirt their orders. And so if he truly is subject to the law, just as anybody else, he should be thrown in jail with the Secret Service right by his side. Now, I really don't know whether that is something that would come to fruition. I definitely think the judge would order it, but I wouldn't be surprised if he sent an emergency appeal and there's some push from the powers that be to have him put on some kind of, know, house arrest watch, no electronics kind of setup. But I also think it would be really important for him to actually go behind bars and be treated just like a civilian, because that's essentially what he is in his criminal ways.
Yeah. And even in the civil case, it would be nice if Donald Trump violates the gag order again, or his attorneys do that, to actually have some accountability. And by the way, the civil case is going to perhaps wrap up in the next couple of days. The defense will have their opportunity later this week, and then we'll see what the judge and what the court will do. But let's move on to our next story. The conflict between Israel and Hamas has now been spilling over to some unfortunate violence here in the United States. And let's start in Indiana, where a woman was arrested after driving her car into a building she believed to be an Israel school, allegedly telling police she acted after watching news about the Israel-Gaza war. And Indianapolis officers were summoned to report of a car crashing into a building at about 11:30 p.m. Friday, according to the Indianapolis Police Department. They arrived to find a car backed into the Israelite School of Universal and Practical Knowledge, reported WXAN, a Fox affiliate in Indianapolis. The police soon identified the driver as Ruba Amongathay, 34 years old, who remained at the scene. The building that Amongathay allegedly struck is affiliated with the Radical Hebrew Israelites, according to the Indianapolis Star. The sect is designated as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which described it as increasingly anti-Semitic, anti-white, anti-LGBTQ, xenophobic, and misogynistic. There were several people inside the Israel School of Universal and Practical Knowledge on Friday evening, including four children between the ages of 7 months and 3 years, but nobody was injured. The woman, Amongathay, was taken into custody at the scene of the crash and booked into jail on a preliminary charge of criminal recklessness. Amongathay told one officer she had been watching the news and could not breathe anymore, police said in its statement. She referenced her people back in Palestine. Police said Amongathay acknowledged passing by the building a few times and spotting the Israel school. Police said she did it on purpose. The Jewish Federation of Greater Indianapolis said in a statement that the building had a semblance of a Star of David on the front door. Although a Jewish facility was not targeted solely due to ironic misidentification, as the Washington Post points out, this is yet another reminder to maintain security protocols, remain vigilant of suspicious activity, and report at this activity promptly to appropriate authorities. Adrian, I suppose this is inevitable. Passions are so high because of what people are seeing on their television screens, but the idea that anybody would take action against or try to take action against somebody who's Jewish because of what's happening in Israel, or that somebody would take action against a Muslim in the United States because of Hamas, I mean, that's absurd. Why are these people doing it?
Oh, I don't think it's absurd as much as it's par for the course with how our nation rolls. You know, we have been indoctrinated in this mentality of us versus them, of creating a group in some way and ascribing to it monolithic features. And so it's a form of dehumanization. And so when Israel takes action, our mindset is the thought that, oh, well, that implicates all Jews and thus we must attack Jews. And when a Muslim, country or group takes some kind of action, oh, it must be all Muslims. And the Islamophobia, the anti-Semitism, it's rife because it's something that unfortunately is very much a foundational element of how our nation rolls. And we need to confront that if we hope to, get out in front of it. Because when you have instances like this, where this woman attacks this group thinking that they are a Jewish group, or the attack on the gentleman yesterday that left him no longer living in Thousand Oaks, California yesterday, we are going to see more and more of this, unfortunately, because we're unwilling to address the foundational hate that really lurks within our society.
Yeah, it's almost as if Americans were traveling overseas during the Trump administration and Americans were attacked, violently attacked in Europe, say, because Europeans hate Donald Trump. It's almost sort of the same thing. Like, you don't even know whether those Americans actually supported or voted for Donald Trump, but you're holding an entire group of people, the American people, responsible for something that you don't like on your TV screen. And it's sort of a frightening, and it's even more frightening, I suppose, if you're Muslim or if you're Jewish and people are somehow diminishing any of this by making this direct connection. You are responsible for what Israel does, even though in Israel itself, they had literally hundreds of protests against the Netanyahu government over the last several months leading up to October 7th. People in Israel detest Netanyahu by large numbers, and yet people don't see the distinctions. People don't see the difficulties that a member of a particular group has with somebody who may be perhaps religiously affiliated with that group, but politically not. And by the way, you mentioned what happened in California. Let's get to that, where a Jewish man has died after getting into a confrontation during dueling protests over the Israel-Hamas war. Paul Kessler, 69 years old, died at a hospital on Monday, the day after he was struck during pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian demonstrations at an intersection in Thousand Oaks, a suburb northwest of Los Angeles. Authorities said witnesses said Kessler was involved in a physical altercation with one or more counter-protesters, fell backwards and struck his head on the ground. An autopsy on Monday said that Kessler died from blunt force head injury and that it was ruled a homicide, according to the Sheriff's Department, which said that investigators had not ruled out the possibility that the act was a hate crime. No arrests have been made and details of the confrontation have not been immediately released. But Rabbi Michael Barclay of Temple near Simchon Westlake Village, which is near Thousand Oaks, urged people to avoid jumping to conclusions about what happened. He wrote on Twitter, as the rabbi in Westlake, I just got off the phone with the chief of police as of 5:42 p.m. This is the situation. They have conflicting reports of what happened, and they did interview the suspect that is identified in social media at the event. They have no video. The rabbi went on to tweet, please do not make assumptions or accusations until the police can do their job and we get real video. All postings otherwise are not accurate at this time. It is not being handled by Los Angeles law enforcement, and the police here are clear. Some refreshing restraint from that rabbi, given how riled up a lot of people may be. Adrian, in order to sort of prove a case against whoever might have pushed Kessler, if that's what happened, what are the elements that would be needed?
Well, it depends on kind of what charges you bring, because if the thought was to harm him in some way and you knew that you were using some kind of deadly force in some way, that, you know, that could be an aggravated level of murder or second degree, first degree manslaughter or something like that. If it was something that was merely reckless and they were both pushing and shoving, then that could be a definite lower charge. It really just depends on the circumstances. But I definitely agree with that rabbi and people not jumping to conclusions. I've seen statements being put out, almost speaking to the hate crime element of saying, oh, this is definitely anti-Semitic. And the thing is we don't know that yet. And we should wait and figure out what happened, because again, we cannot have these narratives that anybody who is a counter-protester to Israel is advancing anti-Semitism. That just hurts so many people, especially when there are instances of anti-Semitism out there. And if this turns out to be that, then my God, we really, really, once again, as I said before, we need to confront the anti-Semitism as well as the Islamophobia and all the other isms that run deep within our society. But as far as this case goes, we need to wait and figure out what actually happened here and hold people accountable, because we also cannot have protesters engaging in violence or fighting. It's not going to help in any way with what's going on in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think all of us support protests as long as they're peaceful protests. And yes, maybe there's even a time to be arrested for sitting in the middle of a street, but the idea that you engage in violence. And by the way, Adrian, I've sort of noticed, and to be clear, I lived in Israel for a year when I was younger. I speak Hebrew, I speak a little bit of Arabic. I've traveled to the Middle East repeatedly. My last two jobs, one was at an Israeli-based channel, another was Al Jazeera. I've seen sort of both sides of the coin. So I know the region well, but my sense is that most Americans, even people who are really sort of well-informed, are not saying much because it is so complicated and because there is so much historical sort of nuance and counterclaims. And as a result, I think people just don't want to offend anybody, so they don't say anything. But sometimes that can come across as indifference to the violence and inhumanity. And so what I've said to a lot of people is say, look, you know, reach out to your Jewish friends and say, hey, I get that this is a tough time with anti-Semitism on the rise and with people unfairly making the connection between you being Jewish and the atrocities that may be happening from Israel against Palestinians and Hamas in Gaza. But I also think it's worth also reaching out to Muslim friends and saying, hey, I get the sensitivities you're feeling because of the rise in Islamophobia, and then I stand with the Muslim community for peaceful protests and actions. Just, I think saying that would reassure so many members of our community, because it does feel like the silence, while I think sort of well-intentioned, nobody wants to offend anybody else, I think there's so many Americans that are hurting and are feeling sort of lonely because of the images that are coming in, the high tensions and the violence in the Middle East, and because of the rise in hatred in the United States.
Absolutely, without a doubt. And I completely and totally co-sign on what you said. I was a delegate to Israel earlier this year, where basically individuals who are Arab Israelis and also Palestinian Israelis have brought me over to talk about the segregation issues that they were facing, and also the Ethiopian Jews and the racial issues that they were struggling with, and what they were trying to do to help ameliorate that and to create a more desegregated society. And so I had a lot of opportunity to have that exposure and experience, and to get to know what the issues are that they are confronted with just within the borders of Israel. And so having somewhat of an intimate knowledge of some of the issues that are going on there, it's so clear that we as Americans generally have no real insight. And we do have a monolithic thought in theory of individuals who are in other countries or who are members of other cultures in any way. And that is not what we need to have. We need to realize that everybody is an individual. And just because someone might be a citizen of a certain country, just like in the United States here, doesn't mean that they abide by their leadership and that they co-sign with them. And so reaching out to your colleagues, your friends, letting you know that you support them. And I also believe that, to some extent, you need to reach out to people who may appear as if they're from a certain group because of the rise in hate. And because we know that ignorant and hateful people do not distinguish. So you may have individuals who are, like a very good girlfriend of mine is Mexican, but she looks Arab. And so she could definitely be under attack. And so letting people know, hey, if you want someone to accompany you to the grocery store, or hey, if something goes down and you need some protection, or being a little bit more mindful, that really can go the distance in terms of being an ally.
Yeah, and to your point about our common humanity is such an important starting point, because regardless of what our views may be of any particular conflict or any particular issue, even here in the United States, I feel like if we can all start with the foundation as well, I recognize the humanity of everybody. People who look like me, people who are different than me, people who have the same religion, different political party, MAGA world, I recognize their humanity. And if you start there, then it feels like, well, then you can start to have a discussion, a reasonable discussion about differences in policy or opinion, but you can keep it sort of peaceful and recognize, yeah, of course we all recognize nobody wants somebody else to die. Nobody else wants, you know, MAGA to be, you know, people to be shot or critics of MAGA to be, you know, beaten up by far. I mean, the point is humanity. If we can all simply say, look, we support each other's humanity, that's our starting point. Then it becomes, I think, a little bit easier for all of us to have these more difficult conversations about, okay, what is the right policy and what are our different point of views and where might we find some agreement?
I couldn't agree more. We just need to do so much in terms of reaching across the aisle, reaching out to our friends, checking ourselves. Also, I've noticed, at least among my colleagues and my friends, is that a lot of people, unfortunately, particularly from Jewish communities, they feel like their mourning and their loss of what happened on October 7th wasn't recognized because it's been overshadowed by the wildly disproportionate and just cruel response from Netanyahu. And so, honestly, letting people know, I see you. I know you're suffering. I know people from your community have been taken as hostage, and I want your loved ones back too. And just letting people know, because I know we are speaking out so much for Palestinians and for Gaza, we also have to remember that there are other people also suffering, and we want all humanity and human life to be preserved.
So well said. We are going to take a break, and we're going to do something during this break that I have not had a chance to do at TYT, and that is actually try to read your comments live. We'll see how that goes. And then we'll be back with the rest of the show and some interesting segments about Election Day coming up after this. And we're back, and this is Election Day. Woo-hoo! So do your civic duty and go. You'll feel better about yourself if you vote. Never mind who you vote for. Just participate. Participate in democracy. It makes you feel good. I got a couple of kids. One of them asked if I can bring her to the voting booth. Sure, why not? Everybody should learn how to vote and realize that this is a good thing. Now, there's some specific things that are happening across the United States. In Ohio, for example, abortion rights is on the ballot and about whether it's going to be a constitutional amendment. Kentucky is choosing their next governor. And in Virginia, control of the Virginia legislature is at stake. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin is currently sparring with the NAACP over felony voting rights ahead of the election. The NAACP said on Monday that Youngkin's administration lacks clear standards for restoring voting rights to convicted felons who have served their sentences. The group's assertion followed the administration administration's release of emails between state officials and people whose requests were denied. So the Washington Post reports, the governor has deemed you ineligible for rights restoration at this time, the email states, while telling applicants they can reapply in a year. Applicants receive no explanation or justification for their denials, while the state has provided no stated standards for who is eligible or ineligible for restored voting rights, the NAACP said in a statement Monday. In a late August email released by the state, someone who was clearly upset by the rejection pressed for more information. Is there a reason why, wrote the person whose name was redacted, after all, I feel I deserve an explanation because I'm not a violent felon and I'm trying to do something with my life. I wanted to start taking classes towards law enforcement to be on the right side of the law instead of the wrong. This is very discouraging. This person was not given a reason. In Virginia, a felony conviction automatically results in the loss of certain rights, such as voting, serving on a jury, running for office, or carrying a firearm. The governor has the sole discretion to restore them, with the exception of firearm rights, which is only something a court can do. Youngkin's administration confirms that it has shifted away, at least partly, from automatic restoration systems used by Democratic predecessors. At least three lawsuits have been filed challenging what critics call an opaque process that could result in discrimination. The NAACP is also criticizing what documents the administration wants from people during the application process. The documents include requests by the Youngkin administration for information about applicants from various state agencies, including Virginia's Department of Elections. The NAACP said the request was puzzling and suggested information being gathered was likely to include voting history. The group noted that Youngkin has refused to publicly state how he uses this information to determine whether to restore a citizen voting rights. The process is apparently also extremely slow in terms of approval or denial of the applications. The NAACP has warned that the restoration process is operating at an increasingly slow pace, potentially blocking thousands of people from participating in elections. The Washington Post reports in a letter accompanying the documents released on Friday, the governor's office said that more than 1,000 applications submitted between January 2022 and October 23 have not yet been processed because they are incomplete or more information has been requested. The administration said that it has processed all applications that contain complete information through late September. About 40 applications are still pending while the administration waits for a response from a state agency, the governor's office said. Former Secretary of the Commonwealth K. Cole James defended the slow process. James said in her July letter that Youngkin is less likely to quickly restore the voting rights of anyone who used a firearm in the commission of a crime. She also wrote that Youngkin will also, generally speaking, but not always, work to restore the voting rights of those who committed nonviolent crimes. I think this all means that basically Youngkin is slowing down a process that had been in place before, that once you've served your time for the crime, you get to vote again. It was a fairly automatic process, but now the Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, who a lot of Republicans are asking to jump in the presidential race and challenge Donald Trump, while he has slowed the process down, almost seems to be slow walking it. And what happens is, of course, perhaps thousands of people get disenfranchised and cannot exercise their fundamental right to vote. Adrian, what's really going on here?
It really seems that it's a continuation of trying to disenfranchise Black voters. This is something that's been happening really since the opportunity to vote has been extended to Black individuals in the United States. And you have members of the Republican Party continuing to put these hurdles out in front of individuals while other parts of the system completely continue to play their role in seeking to really silence marginalized voices so that people do not have an opportunity to say how they want their country run, how they want decisions made. And it's laughable at this point how some people will completely think this is a democracy when it's really not, given all the efforts that are put in to silence and to keep marginalized people from playing a role in the democratic process.
I also wonder if Republicans felt comfortable actually appealing to marginalized people rather than throwing up these sort of process roadblocks. What they would do is say, look, vote for us and here's why. Here's what we've done with, criminal justice reform, or here's how we've made the prisons better, or here's how we've streamlined processes for once people get out of prison to get training. Make an appeal to people, whether they're prisoners, whether they're a particular ethnic group. Explain to them, here's why you vote for me. That's how the democracy is supposed to work. But it feels like every time somebody throws up a process hurdle, makes it more difficult to find a voting location, says you can't vote early, limits the number of precincts or voting machines in African-American districts, says that criminals or ex-cons can't vote even though they're entitled to do so, that's simply fear. That's simply fear that you as a political party have lost with that particular segment of society, and you know it. And as a result, you're simply trying to keep those people from voting. Is that too extreme for me to say that?
No, the fact is that it would be great if either of the political parties would actually show that they invest in these marginalized groups, that they actually want to make meaningful change, whether it is greater and more significant enforcement of civil rights laws, actually trying to create some kind of reparations for even just the housing law violations that are civil rights based that have been going on in this nation for 100 years plus. Something that would say that, hey, I'm looking to ensure that you as a citizen of the United States are recognized and treated as a whole person. But no, that's not the case. Instead, the efforts are to continue to silence and marginalize groups to keep them disenfranchised.
And in Virginia, of course, it's especially pernicious because, look, Virginia has been a trending blue state. It was once a pretty solid Republican state. It has now become something more sort of moderate. Democrats have won gubernatorial races there. Democratic presidents have won there before. So when you actually are able to disenfranchise and keep certain voters from participating, that can have real consequences, particularly on battles for the state legislature, on candidates who may have their victory determined by, you know, a couple thousand votes. Well, suddenly, if you've got a couple thousand people, say, in Fairfax County or Arlington County who can't participate because the governor's not allowing them to, even though they've served their time, they've met all the requirements to being able to vote, that can have a direct impact on who might be representing that county in the state legislature. In Ohio, abortion is very much on the ballot today. The question there is whether or not there's a abortion protections can be enshrined. And so there is wall-to-wall disinformation. We're going to break down some of this in the Ohio vote today in a moment. But we also want to let you know about some of the dirty tricks that are underway. But first of all, Governor Mike DeWine, he says, Well, let me just read this. Ohio issue one, here's the text. Established in the Constitution of the state of Ohio, an individual right to one's own reproductive medical treatment, including but not limited to abortion. Prohibit the state from directly or indirectly burdening, penalizing, or prohibiting abortion before an unborn child is determined to be viable, unless the state demonstrates that it is using the least restrictive means. Always allow an unborn child to be aborted at any stage of pregnancy, regardless of viability, if in the treating physician's determination the abortion is necessary to protect the woman's life or health. Now, less clear, but clear cut on this is the sort of the ballot language. So no changes are expected related to minors obtaining abortions in the state, as there's already a legal process for that. Judicial bypass, as it stands now, has been around 2012 in the state after then Governor John Kasich has signed a law that prohibited forcing a minor to have an abortion, but leaves in place a legal way for minors to petition juvenile courts to bypass parental consent. The legal method uses the court system to allow underage individuals to make decisions for themselves where parental consent would typically be necessary, such as in cases of abuse. All right, well, given all of this, and it's a little bit confusing, let's hear how the state governor, Mike DeWine, let's listen to what he had to say about all of this.
If you look at issue one, it's a radical proposal. And whether you're pro-choice or pro-life, it just goes much, much too far. It would enshrine in our Constitution the right to have an abortion up until birth, so at any time during the pregnancy. The second thing it would do is really threaten a law that we've had on the books for many years that requires parental consent if we're dealing with a minor.
Actually, that's not what this ballot amendment would do, but obviously Mike DeWine, he's got the platform of being governor, so he can spin this and mislead people because obviously he's pro-life and doesn't like the idea that Ohio voters might actually support giving women certain basic rights for their reproductive health and freedom. Now, while lying about ballot measures is nothing new for the Republican Party, they're using of taxpayer funds to push a certain outcome. Well, that may be. And the Ohio Senate has launched its on-the-record blog in September describing the page, the only one linked under the official site's news tab, is the Chamber's own online newsroom, publishing the views the news excludes. Well, in the weeks leading up to the election, On the Record has focused its coverage on denouncing issue one, publishing articles from state senators that repeat the claims of abortion access outlined in the Protect Women Ohio ad alongside others. One claims the amendment would allow for the dismemberment of fully conscious children, referring to a procedure that the U.S. government banned in 2003, while another decontextualizes the high rates of abortion among Black women to further a narrative that the rate is fueled by an evil and predatory abortion industry. There's been, look, with all the confusion, misinformation efforts to try to spin what seems to me a pretty clear-cut effort by voters in Ohio to protect women's rights. Nonetheless, there has been an incredible sort of surge of early voting, in part driven by this issue of abortion rights and women's rights. Through Sunday, voters had cast 864,525 ballots compared to 757,653 who voted early for the entire August election. The numbers include the 79,388 people who voted early and in person on Saturday and Sunday during the state's first and only weekend hours for early in-person voting. Adrian, a couple of things to pick apart here. First of all, the use of taxpayer funds, whether even if it's a blog, to spread misinformation about a ballot issue, could there be some legal vulnerability with that?
Not likely the case, especially if it's something that a member of the government did, you know, but it does speak to how insidious a lot of these efforts to get people to continue to subscribe to your ideology, that you have to swindle them, you have to lie to them and misrepresent what the laws are in order to get people to back them. That's not democracy and that's not how it should work. If anything, that's an admission of the fact that you should not be in a position to represent that body of people. And the thing that I would think about Ohio right now is that they had all of the controversy and all the headlines about the 10-year-old girl who was raped and became pregnant and had to go to Indiana for an abortion. And so Ohio is doing everything it can in terms of its leadership to say, don't worry, we have situations like this covered. And it's really not a problem, but really it is, given the language that they're choosing for their proposed legislation.
Allow an individual's right to one's own reproductive medical treatment, including but not limited to abortion. I think if you would poll people on that, without sort of all of the distractions and without all the false ads and without all the false blogs, and when that has been polled across the United States, 80% of American people support that. Well, when they're then told that you're now supporting abortion rights, maybe it drops a little bit, but most people who are even pro-life, even most people who are pro-life say, I may be opposed to abortion personally, but I do believe that in the state constitution or in the federal constitution, there should be a right for a woman to choose what's best for her between her and her doctor. And again, that's essentially what Ohio was trying to do. And then this article one is also trying to make sure that the state cannot throw up all sorts of roadblocks. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes. As we've seen, though, in previous elections, abortion, at least ever since the Supreme Court in the Dobbs decision got rid of Roe versus Wade, every single ballot measure, every single election that has been about should there be a constitutional amendment banning abortion, should there be something supporting abortion, abortion rights has always won. And that's in part because I think the polling is so clear and dominant on this issue that people recognize that abortion rights, women's rights are under fire. And even for Republicans, moderate Republicans, even some pro-life folks, they believe this should be a woman's right to choose. So my prediction is that, as has happened in Ohio, I think there was another issue in Ohio a year ago, I have a feeling that the people supporting Text One are going to be successful, and this will be enshrined in the Ohio Constitution. But we'll see what the voters decide, and we'll have, of course, some results that we can analyze. We're going to take another break and be back right after this. And welcome back. Issue E. Marjorie Taylor Greene, she hates the Republican Party. What is going on? A Georgia Republican House member, she lashed out at her fellow Republican colleagues. Watch.
Republican voters across the country are sick and tired of Republicans. Many of the American people that think that Republicans in Congress completely fail them. I feel the same way.
Wait, is this a day where I agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene? Is it like that day when she talked about all the amazing things? Well, she didn't call them amazing, but all the things Joe Biden had done, essentially continuing the Great Society efforts of Lyndon Baines Johnson. Of course, she didn't know she was supporting Joe Biden. And maybe she doesn't know that she's supporting the view that many of us have that the Republican Party is insane, but that's what she's doing. Well, let's listen to some extended comments to get a little bit more context. Watch.
Republican voters across the country are sick and tired of Republicans because they never do anything to hold this government accountable. Republicans go out on the campaign trail and go on TV and do their 5-minute hearing videos and post up on social media and say all this garbage about how they're going to fight it and stop it. Well, I feel like many of the American people that think that Republicans in Congress completely fail them. I feel the same way, and I'm a Republican member of Congress.
Now, Green also warned Johnson that if he agrees to a deal for billions in aid to Ukraine, the MAGA base, she said, will be, quote, absolutely furious.
Well, sadly, Marjorie Taylor Greene is right about Ukraine. According to polls from last month, Republican voters have started turning against Ukraine. When asked, helping Ukraine against Russia, the Biden administration should be, quote, doing more. 31% of Democrats say do more. Independents say 24% do more. Republicans, 23% do more. Do less. 15% of Democrats say do less. Independents say 41% do less. 56% of Republicans say do less to help Ukraine. Handling things right with Ukraine, 54% are Democrats, 35% of Independents. Only 21% of Republicans believe that we are doing the right thing by supporting Ukraine. Adrian, this feels like a really big split in the Republican Party between the, I suppose you could call them the neocons, the hawks who believe that we should be doing everything possible to help Ukraine, and then the more isolationist wing of the Republican Party, of which Marjorie Taylor Greene subscribes, who believes, no, we shouldn't be sending money to Ukraine. This split, how significant is it?
I think it is pretty significant, as we've seen with the GOP in particular, with their recent split on who should be House Speaker. Like, these people are an absolute mess, that when they cannot come together and decide in unity how things should proceed, that essentially our government ultimately comes to a halt, at least in the House. And so we have to be mindful of this moving forward. But also, I completely understand Marjorie Taylor Greene's sentiment. To the extent it weren't coming from someone who has all sorts of ulterior motives, I would say it's pretty legit. As an American, I am tired of the thought that we are funding wars. The thought that we also, well, the reality that we do not have healthcare, that we don't have so many basic social services, that our tax dollars are being used to advance harm on individuals or to help other individuals continue to fight, when it's billions and millions of dollars, when we can't even fight to stay alive. A lot of us out here who don't have any kind of healthcare services. It's just, it's exhausting.
Yeah, it would be nice if Congress actually tied Ukraine aid to, I don't know, expanding healthcare. Unfortunately, Republicans only want to tie it to tightening the U.S. immigration laws. Here's the headline from NBC News. Republicans threaten to reject Ukraine aid unless Democrats agree to tighten U.S. immigration laws. Some GOP lawmakers, even those who support Ukraine, insist Congress will not pass a funding bill to help it without also changing asylum laws in the United States. Marjorie Taylor Greene is also making that link between immigration and Ukraine. Of course, she hates Ukraine aid and is happy to sort of criticize it, even if Republicans do get the additional border fencing and immigration spending that and security fencing that the Biden administration has promised. By the way, one other thing that has made Marjorie Taylor Greene mad about the GOP is that they rejected her censure of Representative Tlaib. Marjorie Taylor Greene wrote on Twitter, I'm reintroducing my censure resolution against, she calls it, terrorist Tlaib. I am removing insurrection, replacing it with illegal occupation on October 18th that broke the same federal laws as January 6th, led to hundreds of arrests and assault on Capitol Police. Marjorie Taylor Greene wrote, hopefully the 23 Republicans who voted no to censure pro-terrorist, pro-Hamas, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic Rashida Tlaib will use their freedom of speech in Congress to ensure condemn terrorist Tlaib's speech, lies, and actions that incited an illegal occupation on October 18th. Yes, there was a demonstration October 18th. No police officers got beaten up. I think there was two people who were arrested for disorderly conduct. So for Marjorie Taylor Greene to make the comparison between what she saw on October 18th with a bunch of pro-Palestinians peacefully demonstrating in the Capitol and what happened on January 6th is simply insane. The other part about it is when Marjorie Taylor Greene describes a member of Congress like Rashida Tlaib, who may have a different point of view in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and may even speak about the conflict in ways that I do not like, to describe Congressman Tlaib as a terrorist, well, that actually diminishes what terrorism really means, and it diminishes the suffering of people who actually suffer from terrorists in the region. Anyway, Adrian, your thoughts?
You are 100% accurate and on point. And the thing is it's coming to the point where it's, of course, making Marjorie Taylor Greene look off her rocker, which is something that she is generally comfortable doing. But it's making her seem extraordinarily extreme. But I think this is in part some of what the GOP likes to do. Marjorie Taylor Greene will take up, she'll take up the opportunity to go to these extreme lengths, to use language that diminishes the importance of whatever significant topic she's talking about, just so she can wage her own little personal war on members of the left. And the thing is that there are members of her party who completely and totally condone this. They enjoy it. She's their little attack dog willing to get dirty. And the thing is that it's causing a lot of people to run to the aid of Rashida Tlaib. And I think it's going to backfire big time on Marjorie Taylor Greene.
We're going to take a break and be more with the aftermath right after that.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.